today, were there other Tiananmens in China in 1989? And Patrick Winter reports on violence against pro-democracy protesters, this time in Sudan, where at least 100 were killed on Monday.
It was noontime today in the center of Beijing when a man walked to the middle of the Avenue of Eternal Peace, which, as it happened, was already occupied. He walked to the middle and stood there. The man was alone. The tank was not. It wasn't just a single tank he stopped. There were 18 tanks and armored carriers.
When people think about Tiananmen, they often think about Tank Man, the man standing in front of the column of tanks on June 5th, 1989, just outside of Tiananmen Square in Beijing. And I was talking with one of the student leaders from Beijing, and he said that actually there were hundreds of tank men, just Beijing citizens and other protesters and workers who were trying to stand up to the military and stand up to the government.
And it wasn't just in Beijing. Lily Kuo's reporting on 30 years since the Tiananmen massacre stretched thousands of miles across China, from the southwest to the east and the north of the country. In each of these places, The Guardian's Beijing bureau chief found people with stories of how the 1989 protest movement had taken place in over 300 cities across China. And in at least one, Lily spoke to victims of a government crackdown that mirrored events in Tiananmen. While people remember June the 4th in Beijing, in Chengdu, one mother remembers June the 6th, the last day she saw her son alive. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, China's other Tiananmens.
Hello.
Tang Ding is an 83-year-old mother from Chengdu in southwestern China, thousands of miles from Beijing.
Lily Kuo is The Guardian's Beijing bureau chief.
She is the mother of four, kind of a peasant farmer family. They live outside of Chengdu. And she's a very feisty, kind of salty woman. She speaks with a very strong Sichuanese accent, and she speaks very directly and to the point. And she has been spending the last 30 years trying to seek redress for the death of her son.
Who is her son?
Her son is Zhou Guocong, the youngest of four children. The last time that Tang saw him was on June 6, 1989, about 4 p.m., she says. Zhou was 17 years old. He had just finished middle school. He wasn't very good at school, so he wasn't going to keep studying, so he was just going to start working and contributing to the family. And he had gotten a job, sort of a temp job, at an iron pipe factory in Chengdu, kind of in the center of Chengdu. And so he went out on June 6th, and he never came home. And at the time in Chengdu, the city was kind of overtaken by student protesters and angry residents who were protesting the fact that there had been a very violent crackdown on student protesters in Beijing, which is known as the Tiananmen Massacre, the Tiananmen Crackdown, or as the Chinese government calls it, the Tiananmen Incident.
But Chengdu is thousands of miles away from Beijing.
Right. So Chengdu is very far from Beijing, and there were protests in Chengdu and more than 300 other cities at the time. And there were actually a lot of protests in reaction to the June 4th crackdown.
Now in Chengdu, all is calm beneath the overpowering statue of Mao Zedong. Like dirt under a carpet, the authorities have swept evidence of the students' fury behind the statue, where apparently they hope it will not be noticed. Burnt-out government cars and minibuses, military motorcycles, a fire truck, a dozen or more trolley buses, rusting reminders of a call for freedom.
And do we know what happened to Zhou Guotong on the night of June the 6th, 1989?
So Tang and the family, they spent that night trying to find him. Tang went out looking. She went around asking his former classmates if they had seen him or if he was with them, asking relatives. And eventually they got information that he had been detained by the police. And then it wasn't for another 2 months that they finally got confirmation that he was dead.
那天是什么？
Joe's sister, who was 20 at the time, she remembers being in the next room and hearing her parents crying the whole night. She says that that night that her father's hair turned white and that just the whole family didn't sleep that night. And then it wasn't until 11 years later that Tang, who in this time continued to press for some sort of justice for her son, some sort of compensation for the family. She was suing the police. It wasn't until 11 years later that she got a photo of her son's body. His sister described seeing the photo, just seeing him laying there, and she described his nose and his face covered in blood.
What was the official reason for his death?
So there wasn't an official reason, and they never received a real explanation.
And what do the family believe happened to their son?
Well, they've never directly said what they believe, but it's clear that he died in police custody. And when you hear June 1989, most people think about the Tiananmen massacre.
No one knows how many people have died in the crackdown. We may never know. At least 300 have died. The figure may be as high as 3,000 or more. Many were civilians who went into the street unarmed to challenge the military and were mowed down by machine gun fire or run over by tanks.
Between hundreds and thousands of protesters in Tiananmen in Beijing were killed, but thousands of miles away from Beijing in Chengdu, there were people like Zhou who were also killed in a government crackdown on student protests there. And it turns out that at this time in 1989, a less studied part of what happened in 1989 is the fact that there were protests in more than 300 other cities. And the lack of information and the lack of transparency and the censorship around this time period, we don't know how many other Tiananmens there were. We don't really know what else happened across the country.
So these protests were pro-democracy protests, but when you look back at some of the videos, you see students singing these kind of left-wing pro-socialist anthems. So they weren't completely against communism. What was the core belief?
The students, they saw themselves as patriots, and they didn't necessarily want to overturn the Communist Party. When they're calling for democracy, they wanted democratic reforms. They wanted political reforms. They wanted freedom of speech. They wanted an end to corruption. They wanted freedom of press. They wanted government officials to declare their assets. So they wanted things to change. They didn't necessarily want to overturn the whole system.
And how were their freedoms being curtailed?
So the 1980s was this time in China where things were opening up. China had wanted to kind of upgrade the economy, and so they wanted to open the country to new ideas. But at the same time that there was this kind of loosening of life and ideas and thinking and debate on university campuses, there were also still these restrictions and this kind of like leftover system from the planned economy where all aspects of your life were determined by your danwei, your work unit, or your university in this case. Students had all of these rules on their lives, so you couldn't date until your third year of university. And then if you were dating, you had to register your relationship. There were certain times when you could listen to music or sit on your bed and, you know, you had a bedtime. And the universities also determined where you worked afterward. They would assign you to jobs. So, you know, in that environment of both giving people more freedom and then also restricting them, students, they wanted, when they talked about freedom, one of those freedoms was personal freedoms.
And we know what happened next. The protests, which had seen over a million people in Tiananmen Square at one point, were winding down. But then the government sent in tanks.
Troops have been firing indiscriminately, but still, there are thousands of people on the streets who will not move back.
Shots were sprayed. Students and bystanders were killed indiscriminately.
There was confusion and despair among those who could hardly credit that their own army was firing wildly at them.
Hundreds, maybe several thousand, died. There was a scene of carnage on June the 4th, and then on June the 5th, that iconic Tankman image. What was happening there?
So Taekmin, that photo was taken June 5th, so after most of the violence had ended. And there's also a video of it too, which is fascinating. He steps out in front of a column of tanks. He does a little dance with the tank for a little bit, so the tanks try to get around him, and he keeps stepping in its way. And then at one point he goes up to one of the tanks and he climbs on top, bangs on the roof thing, and then speaks to the soldier. And then he comes back down.
But when bystanders rushed in to save this stubborn soul, it wasn't easily done. He was pushed away at last, faceless in the crowd.
It's not clear if the people who grabbed him and took him away are other protesters or citizens who just, you know, thought this wasn't safe for him, or if those could have been police or security.
One man alone, of course, can't stop an army. Except for a moment, that's exactly what happened here. A man who'd made up his mind, it seems, though why, we just don't know. What moves a man to just stand still? Is it courage or outrage or madness? We can't tell what was on his mind, and we can't forget what he did.
You're working in China as our bureau chief in Beijing. Did you think that this was a Beijing story?
I knew that in 1989 there was a protest movement and that it was students in China more broadly, not just in Beijing, but I didn't know the extent of those protests. And when we started doing this story, there were so many people. There were so many people that had been part of the protests in their hometowns and knew of people in other cities. And I realized it didn't just happen in Beijing. It happened really across the country.
And how connected were the other protests to the Beijing one?
It very much is the case that the students elsewhere in the country were taking their lead from Beijing, and they would mirror what was happening in Beijing with the lag of a couple of days, maybe. But there was a lot of communication. In Beijing, there were special teams to go out to the other protest cities and communicate with them and see what was going on. They would send faxes between the cities. One protester that we spoke to who helped organize students in Lanzhou, they had a hotline. They had a phone line directly to Beijing, and they would call every hour and get an update. And then they would broadcast it from the university radio station, which they had taken over.
And what did those other protesters do when they heard about what happened in Beijing?
We interviewed somebody who was part of a protest movement in Qingdao on the East Coast. And he remembered that he was woken up by students yelling, and the students were all pouring into the streets, and they'd had their radios with them, and they were broadcasting the foreign media, so Voice of America or Hong Kong media, saying what had happened in Beijing, and that people were so angry. They had hung bottles, these glass bottles in trees. So the idea was to hang Deng Xiaoping. Deng Xiaoping was the leader at the time who had approved the crackdown. And part of his name sounds like small bottle, so they're calling for him to be hung. And then this protester that we spoke to, he also saw people burning their Communist Party membership cards. And I just remember him saying, you know, that they knew that it was dangerous, but they were so angry that they couldn't control themselves.
So, Lily, as we're speaking, it is June the 4th. Tiananmen Square, the massacre, is being remembered all over the world. I'm here in the UK. When I woke up this morning, I put the radio on. There was a huge amount of coverage about it. The same is happening in countries everywhere. What is happening in Beijing?
So every year in Beijing, it's met with complete silence. We looked at the newspapers today and the state newspapers. The front page stories are about Xi Jinping, the Chinese leader, promoting garbage sorting, this environmental campaign, or speeches by him about strengthening the Communist Party. No mention of what happened this day 30 years ago.
30 years on, the Chinese government has erased every reminder of those events 30 years ago.
And Tiananmen Square, which is a major tourist destination, every year there's extra security. This morning I tried to go get into the square and just see the scene, and they were trying to scan the IDs of every person that was coming in. Normally they're security checks, but they normally just kind of check your bag and let you go through. So there was just these huge lines of people waiting to get in. There was extra security, so I kind of walked around the perimeter. There's basically like a SWAT car. There were police everywhere. There were plainclothes police. There was a guy that was dressed as a kind of a street repairman sitting in the corner just staring at us. There's no way that you can commemorate the event publicly here or even in private with a group of people. So there's a group of Chinese activists who are in China who are always under a lot of surveillance this day, and they have all said that they're going to spend the day fasting, and that's really the only way that they can remember it.
What would happen if they did anything else?
they would be put in jail. They'd be arrested.
This attempt to pretty much erase the memory of Tiananmen, did this begin in the immediate aftermath?
It began right afterwards, yes. At first, it wasn't so much about erasing it as establishing a new narrative about what happened. There was a barrage of propaganda describing the government's actions as, the government had successfully quelled this counter-revolutionary revolt and the country could return to normal. And then after that, the only mentions of it in history books are along those lines. And then it basically just disappears from Chinese history.
And how effective has it been? I mean, what do young people who you meet know about Tiananmen?
It's mixed. In a way, it is effective. I think a lot of young people today don't know about it, or they know only very little about it. They kind of know roughly that something happened then, but they're not too concerned about it. But at the same time, every year, there's still information that gets out about the protests, and there's still people finding ways to market. So they're posting poems or songs. It seems that people do remember. And also the fact that so many people were part of these protests in so many parts of the country, I think that also makes it hard to forget.
The journalist Louisa Lim has suggested that the consequences of suppressing the history of Tiananmen has actually created a generation of people who believe that talking about it could be bad for stability. Is there any truth in that?
There was an editorial that came out in this Global Times newspaper, the state-run newspaper, and they make that same argument that dropping the Tiananmen incident, as they would call it, from the public discourse is for the good of the country, and it's so that the country could move forward and not be, not just stay in this shadow. And that is definitely part of the narrative, that after 1989, China went through a couple of years of international isolation and sanctions, and then they focused entirely on economic reforms, and the economy exploded. 1990s, 2000s, the Chinese economy grew very quickly. And so that history is their way of justifying how they acted, that we wouldn't have been able to come this far if we hadn't done what we did then.
And what about Zhou Guotong's family? I mean, are they safe talking to you about what happened to their son?
After we spoke with Zhou Guotong's mother, Tang Dean, on the phone, we called her back a few days later to follow up on something. And she started telling us how, after we called, within a few hours, there was a car outside of her window, outside of her apartment, to keep an eye on her. And that the next day that there were three cars waiting there. And she wasn't scared. She was just mad. Zhou's sister says that they don't need an apology. They don't need some sort of acknowledgement from the government about what happened. They just want something that can end this. She's seen her mother consumed by this for the last 30 years. And, she's 83 now, and they just want her to live her kind of remaining years in peace and some sort of closure.
And what about what the students were protesting for? 30 years on, are we any nearer to achieving their ideals in China?
I tried to ask most of the four student protesters that question, and now it seems that the goals have shifted, and they're not necessarily pushing for democracy now. They're pushing for more specific goals, so workers' rights or education rights or land rights. That's a big issue. And in some ways, seems like those goals that they were pursuing in 1989 are further away. This whole space for debate and free speech has really suffered. So in some ways, it seems like we're much farther away than before. More recently, there are these students who are from the Marxist society. So they're ultra patriotic. They completely believe in the communist Marxist cause, to the point that they are trying to help workers in southern China. A student activist that I spoke to said that he's being monitored all the time. Even when he goes to eat in the cafeteria, there's somebody there right next to him. As soon as he turns his phone on, he gets a phone call from his minder saying, just checking in on you. And these are students who say they are emphatic that they are not at all trying to do what the students in 89 were doing. But then at the same time, what some of the people we spoke to said is that this civil society, even though it's been limited, it's had these 30 years to grow, even within those confines. And communication and the internet is much better now. And despite all of the controls, people still find ways.
That was Lily Kuo. You can read all her pieces about the anniversary of Tiananmen at theguardian.com. Coming up, the pro-democracy protesters facing repression in 2019. Now, the Sudanese security forces have been condemned after targeting protesters in Khartoum this week, leaving dozens dead. The Guardian's diplomatic editor, Patrick Winter, has been looking at pressure on Saudi Arabia to exert its political influence to end the crackdown.
The demonstrators in Sudan have been occupying the square in Khartoum in front of the military headquarters since early April, days before President Bashir was overthrown. But as the talks, political talks, have ground on, there's been increasingly signs that the military are not prepared to let them stay there. There's been a shutdown of the internet. There's been the removal of the Al Jazeera television network from Sudan, and wider repression of newspapers, which was seen as a prelude to this kind of attack. And just increasingly, there's been harassment of the protesters. It looks as though this violence that's occurred over the past few days is a great deal worse than was originally feared. There's now reports of as many as 100 people being killed, bodies being dragged out of the River Nile, and hospitals jammed full of bodies with gunshot wounds. The crisis in Sudan really stems from the collapse of the dictatorship of President Omar al-Bashir. Once he fell, there was huge expectations as to whether the country could turn towards democracy, and it led to negotiations lasting through the remainder of April and May between the Sudanese Professional Association, which is really the Sudanese middle class that led the rebellion, and the military that took over power. At the same time, the Sudanese leadership, in particular the military, turned towards Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, both for political support and for financial support. There was a huge injection of UAE and Saudi cash in April to stabilize the exchange rate. Obviously, it's very rare for the UAE or Saudi Arabia to put money into a country without expecting some kind of political influence or quid pro quo. Gradually, the influence of Riyadh has grown. And no one knows the extent to which the brutal violence that occurred this week was with the sanction agreement or cooperation of Riyadh, but it's certainly the case that Riyadh could have reined it in. That's now become clear because the US State Department, in a very unusual move, put out a statement in which they made it absolutely clear that America expected there to be a transition to civilian rule. Now, obviously, America and Saudi Arabia are the closest of allies, so it's very unusual for America to make such a statement and to make it in public in that way. Obviously, it's intended to tell the Saudis that they've got to order the military in Sudan to rein back, whether it's simply a one-off phone call by the Americans to save face, to say they have tried to use their influence, or whether they're going to really press harder, time will tell. But there is a concern in Washington and certainly in Europe about the kind of foreign policy of Saudi Arabia. I think as a result of the international outcry about what's happened, there's some signs that the military are trying to pull back, saying that they're going to conduct an inquiry into what happened, although that will be an inquiry by themselves into themselves. And there's also a promise of holding elections in 9 months' time. Paradoxically, some people fear that's too soon and that if you have elections that quickly, you'll have very little opportunity for political parties to form and for true democracy to flourish. And as a result, some kind of military-backed political party will win.
That was Patrick Winter. My thanks to him and to Lily Kuo. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Mithili Rao and Rachel Humphreys. Sound design was by Axel Cucoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.